KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Six.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Seattle's rental prices are skyrocketing. What's behind the surge? We'll talk with real estate analyst Glenn Crellin just ahead this hour. And GeekWire's Todd Bishop joins us at 10:40 to explain how the Surface tablet has created some financial shortfalls at Microsoft. President Obama's on the road today. He'll deliver a speech at a small Illinois college this morning, the first of six in a series the president is calling an economic conversation with Americans. Bloomberg Business Week editor Peter Coy joins us to explain what the president has in mind. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning to you.
So the president recently has been focused on selling health care, on talking about immigration reform. Why has he shifted sights to the economy now?
I don't think he really shifted sights. I think it's more that it's maybe all along been his single biggest priority for the second term. He wants to get the economy growing again, and the recovery has proceeded, but very slowly. So the latest is the sequester, of course, started March 1st, has actually contributed to the slowness of the economy. What he's trying to do is go over the heads of the Republicans in Congress. He feels he can't convince them of anything, and go straight to the American people, hoping that he can persuade them that the Democrats have the right strategy for economic growth. And while he might not persuade the people in Congress who have opposed him, he might at least make them fearful for their reelection if they oppose his strategy.
Well, that's interesting that he's going to focus some of it on the Republicans, because it seems like at least the House leadership, which is Republican, is gearing up to really not just stand firm against the president, but make massive cuts to the programs that the president has made his priorities.
That's it. And that's why he perceives that he's not going to be able to persuade John Boehner, Paul Ryan, and the others that he's right and they're wrong. That's not the goal. The goal is to address the general public, and he has great confidence in his oratorical skills and his powers of persuasion. If he figures if he can get the people on his side, go outside the beltway, then it might give him at least a shot at winning more of his battles inside the beltway.
You mentioned the sequester and how the economy is improving somewhat, but not a great deal. How will the president position his message? Is it going to be more of an attack on Republicans, or is he going to talk about how the economy is slowly improving?
I think there's going to be an expression that we're likely to hear today called middle out. This is something Obama has used beginning last year, but he's more and more becoming part of his rhetorical arsenal. And the idea of middle out is that the economy thrives when the middle class is strong. Growth starts there with middle class consumption and then broadens from there, rather than being what he characterizes as the trickle-down approach of the Republicans, where the money that the wealthy earn gets spent throughout the economy. So he feels as though he can't just rely on there's a perception that he's trying to fight, that the Democrats are sort of the bleeding hearts who don't care that much about economic growth. And the way to address that is to say, no, we do care very much about economic growth, but we don't believe that that economic growth originates at the top. We think it starts at the middle. And so by helping the middle class, we're helping the economy overall.
We're talking with Peter Coy, economics editor for Bloomberg Business Week. Is this middle out economics something that comes out of the Obama administration?
Well, originated in a 2011 book, and it was amplified this summer in a special issue of Democracy, which is a quarterly journal of ideas that friendly to liberal ideas. And they have a whole special issue devoted to middle out, trying to make it into a meme, kind of the phrase of the summer of the year. this is going to be the way that the Democrats plant their flag and say, yes, we're the party of economic growth, and that's what we're running on.
How sound a theory is it, in your opinion?
Well, I'm sympathetic to the idea that too much inequality is bad for growth, and I have an article I'm working on this week. I'm giving you a little preview that will cite some of that research. But it's also true that consumption is not the be-all and end-all. We happen to have a weakness in consumption now, but as Keynes himself, who dwelt on the dangers of underconsumption, was the first to say, you also need entrepreneurs with animal spirits, which is more of a Republican-sounding point. And it's true, too, that a certain amount of inequality can actually cause people to work harder because they want to pursue that golden dream. So it's a mixed bag, and the Republicans are going to certainly be making those arguments in response to whatever Obama says today.
At this point, the president is setting out with a approval rating that's below 50%, 48%, I think, is the most recent figure that I saw. And I wonder how is that number directly related to the fact that the economy hasn't just bounded back with jobs for everyone?
Well, it's interesting. Bloomberg National Poll in June asked both the overall approval rating, which came in right around that same level, 48, 49, and his standing on the economy, found he had only a 42% approval rating on the economy. So he's not getting credit for the economic recovery we've had so far, nor are the Republicans, by the way, but it hasn't been a strong point for him.
Is it your sense that Americans blame the president for the state of the economy?
No, that question has been asked as well in polls, and Congress has extremely low poll ratings, as you know, is more likely to take the blame. But, Obama wants more than to rate higher than the Republicans or the Congress in general. It is a pretty low hurdle. He wants to be not only be perceived, but to actually be the person who really gets growth going again, so he has a strong second term.
Is there any risk that the president takes in setting out on this six-speech conversation with America tour?
Well, there's the risk that he's going to be perceived as putting old wine in new bottles, that it's purely cosmetics. There's also the risk that if he punches too hard on the middle outline, he'll be painted as a kind of a liberal Keynesian type outside of the mainstream of public opinion. And that's certainly what the Republicans will try to do with this.
I understand that the two-month window for these speeches is directly tied to when we start talking about fiscal cliffs again, which is October 1st. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, even before what happens October 1st is that we start a new fiscal year, and that's Republicans are already threatening not to go along with bills to keep the economy going after keep the federal budget going after the fiscal year begins. So that's threshold number one, and then later on in the fall we'll be hitting another debt ceiling. So Republicans have sort of two tripwires, and they're planning to use both of them to wring concessions from the president.
This morning in the New York Times there was an article about not just the House budget, which is pretty much a slash and burn sort of thing, but that the Senate budget, the Republicans want to tie any movement from their party on the budget to not funding the president's health care, Obamacare. And I'm wondering if you can tease out any movement on the economy from things like health care reform or immigration reform or some of the other big priorities from the Obama administration.
Well, you went back to what are some of the dangers here. Obama would dearly love to move on. He feels that Obamacare is a victory, that it's a notch on his belt, and he succeeded there. And let's move on to the next priority. But the Republicans keep trying to drag him back to Obamacare all over again. They want to repeal it, of course, and now they're trying to defund it. So he at the same time, he wants to start this new initiative, he can't afford to ignore the rearguard action of defending his signature Health Care Act.
It'll be a fascinating fall to watch because it sounds like everybody in Washington, D.C. is heading for a major collision.
Yep, looks that way.
Peter Coy, economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And as we mentioned, President Obama sets out on the road today. He'll be delivering a speech at Knox College in Illinois, the first of six speeches in a series the president is calling An Economic Conversation with Americans. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
World-renowned book lover Nancy Pearl is here with some reading recommendations for you. We'll hear from Nancy in a minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Zimbabwe's Oliver Mtukudzi has delivered almost as many albums as he's had birthdays, 61. His latest, Sarawoga, which means left alone, is a poignant response to the death of his son. We'll hear more and music in a special performance chat. That's next time on Tell Me More.
That's this afternoon at 1 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. It's on HD radio and it's online at KUOW2.org. 67 degrees and sunny in Seattle, expecting sun all day with an afternoon high of 84. It's 9:18. I'm Bernard Ouellette. In a few minutes here, a look at the issue of bullying. How much of a problem is bullying and what can be done? That's just about 15 minutes away.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. I recently, last night, finished the last book on my summer reading pile, which means my Nancy Pearl, her eyes got really big because that's a horrible feeling. There's nothing left. If you have finished your latest summer book and you're wondering what's next, Nancy Pearl is here again. And this is a little mini visit with just a couple of suggestions that should keep you busy or at least keep me out of trouble.
I have two wonderful novels to talk about.
Okay, good.
They're very different from one another, but they share just terrific writing and just really three-dimensional, fully rounded characters who you can't stop thinking about.
That sounds fun.
Or another. So the first one is called Americana, with just American with an A-H.
Ah, like that.
Americana.
Okay.
And it's by a Nigerian writer named Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And this book just blew me away. When you hear her interviewed, she says that very right up front, this is a book about love, race, and hair.
Hair?
Hair. It opens when the main character is going to taking the train to a beauty shop in Newark to get her hair braided. But it was a book that really dealt with these issues of race, which I've been thinking about so much recently, and immigration, what it means to come to America, what it means to give up your family, your belief, the way you live, your culture, and move into this sometimes not welcoming culture. And it deals with immigration in a way that we have never seen before in a novel.
And if I'm remembering correctly, because I've interviewed this author, she came to the United States initially to go to college,
yes.
Right?
And
she's brilliant and has written quite a bit.
Yes. This is her, I think, second novel, but fourth book.
I think
she has two collections of short stories out. And I hadn't read any of the other ones. I think many people probably have. But I have to say that after I finished this book, I started searching out and putting on hold all of her other books. But this book, you know, we have Jhumpa Lahiri, we have so many other people who have written about immigration, mm-hmm. what it means to become an American. And her take on that is so different. And then she goes back in real life to Nigeria. And and then that contrast. So this is also a love story too, because the boy she's in love with all through high school and part of college doesn't come to America initially. But the stuff about race, wow, it just gave me so much to think about, and that's the kind of book I like.
So it's a book multifaceted. It's got something meaty to chew on, but a really good story.
It's a great story, and it's a great love story. I a friend of mine, former book reviewer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, said she didn't necessarily buy that love story. But I have to say, I just bought into it hook, line, and sinker, if that's mixing metaphors.
The book is called American with an A-H, and the author's name again, I'm going to say it slowly and I'll spell the last name. It's Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, A-D-I-C-H-I-E. We don't pronounce that, but you sort of do if you were, I'm not sure what language this is, but she's a lovely person. So
yes, and she did a terrific TED Talk. Someone recently sent me a link to her TED Talk, and I would actually suggest looking at that as well.
Okay, so we're all about Adichie this summer. So
the other book is the third novel and fourth book again, because Jinsey Willett's first book was a collection of short stories. But this is a novel called Amy Falls Down, and it's a sequel to. But you don't have to read the first book at all. This is really independent.
Okay.
But the writing, the novel that it's a sequel to is called The Writing Group.
I told you I don't have any books, so two are good.
But the other one that I would suggest by Jinsey Willett is called Winner of the National Book Award. And these are all books. Well, the winner of the National Book Award, the main character is a spinster librarian. And, you know, I generally like books about librarians by people who have a really mordant wit. And that's what Jinsey Willett has.
Okay. So you liked that book, too?
I liked all of her books.
Okay.
And I would say if readers like Amy Bender, a little bit of elastic realism in their stories, are a little bit quirky, then her collection of short stories, which is called Jenny and the Jaws of Life, is also good. But she is a very slow writer, so we have only had four books in, maybe 20 years. But, in fact, Jenny and the Jaws of Life didn't sell very many books until David Sedaris said that she was one of the best writers that he'd ever read. This was years ago, and everybody wanted to buy it. So Amy Falls Down. Amy Falls Down is the story of, it's very autobiographical, and you know, whether you know anything about the author or not, this cannot be otherwise than her story and her opinions. But it's the story of a writer who has been blocked for a really long time. She can't, she just cannot get anything done. She wrote one very successful novel in the past, in Amy Falls Down. And then she has an accident, and that accident kind of catapults her into writing again. But this is a book to read if you're interested at all in the world of publishing, in the whole ecosystem of critics and authors and publishers and the marketplace. Oh my gosh, she has so much to say, and it's so pointed, and it's just an absolutely fabulous novel.
So I'm assuming that Amy is the protagonist.
Yes, sir.
And Amy is also the protagonist of the writing group?
Of the writing group. And I think it's called the writing group. It could be called the writer's group, but there's something about group in the title. Yes, she was a teacher at this writing group. And then, so Jinsey Willett's sense of humor comes through in all of her books. I mean, who would call your book Winner of the National Book Award? I mean, I remember giving it to, you know, saying to a friend, oh, you should read this book. And she looked at it and she said, oh, it won the National Book Award. I'll definitely like it.
And you said?
And I said, sorry, it did not. But Jinsey Willett is one of those really under the radar writers who should be so much better known.
And it's Jinsey Willett, Willett. When you say humorous writers, the person whose name that just popped into my head was Eleanor Lipman. How would you describe Jency Willett's humor?
Jency Willett's humor is compared to Eleanor Lippman, for example. Jency's humor is much more pointed. It's much more sharp. It's almost satirical. There is not any... It's hard to see any trace of affection that Amy or the author Jency Willett has for that whole ecosystem of how we bring books to the marketplace.
So, Nancy, are you reading that through your lens of the book world?
Well, I am. And I have to say, my gosh, you know, it's so wonderful to see somebody saying all these things that you maybe have thought, but you thought, oh, no, I can't say that. That would be too disruptive or too...
Wow.
Nasty. So it's just fabulous.
And this kind of a book can get published?
Yes. It's because her publisher, which is St. Martin's, the publisher at St. Martin's has published all of her books, and he's a huge fan of hers. And somewhere I read recently an interview that they had done just after Amy Falls Down was published that talks about how they published her first book of short stories, and afterwards, when it didn't sell very much, which usually unknown collections, but collections by unknown writers don't until that David Sedaris, you know, bump.
Yes.
That he then found that she had this unfinished novel lying around in her house and persuaded her that she needed to finish it. So her own story is so close. And in that interview, she talks about how Amy is essentially her. But it's so funny. And I mean, there's a wonderful interview that she does. And she's on, then there's another scene in the book where she's on a panel with this very pretentious writer. And just how people manipulate what they read, and which we all do. I mean, we all read the books that
through our eyes,
through our own eyes, and that is a form of manipulation in a sense. Maybe manipulation is too
well. Yeah, a word. As we all say, there's no such thing as objectivity, because
right.
We all bring our own life experiences
exactly.
to bear. So you're saying we bring our
yes.
life experiences to the interpretation of whatever
yes.
we're reading,
and to the way we feel about it, and what we read. So going back to the Adichie novel, the way I read it, because I've been thinking about race and how, you know, people were talking about we're now living in a post-racial society. I mean, this author just, they're both such good books.
Well, that sounds good. That makes me happy and wanting to run out and grab some. The book Nancy just talked about is by Jency Willett. It's called Amy Falls Down, and it's a sequel to another one that's either called The Writer's Group or The Writing Group, but Jency Willett, she's probably the only Jency Willett on any bookshelf that you're about to come across.
Yes.
The other book, Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Nancy Pearl is author of the Book Lust series, host of Book Lust on the Seattle Channel, and a regular Wednesday, a guest on Weekday. This is Wednesday, but you come on many days, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Good. Okay.
We're looking forward to it.
Me too.
Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Nancy Pearl was talking with KUOW's Marcy Silman, and there's much more from Nancy, recommendations going back years on our website, kuow.org. It's 9:30. I'm Bernard Ouellette. We're going to zoom in on the issue of bullying in a minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Next time on LA Theater Works, Ed Begley Jr. stars in a rollicking and indelicate courtroom comedy.
And my job is
to frame an alternative.
A lie?
You don't want to lie?
If you would let me do my job.
Why did you go to law school if you don't want to lie?
Romance by David Mamet, next time on LA Theater Works.
Friday night at 10 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from University Volkswagen Audi, committed to providing customer care through the exclusive Passport Service Program, which includes service loaner vehicles, rideshare shuttle service, and a knowledgeable staff. More information online at uvwaudi.com.
It's another sunny day in Seattle. We're expecting to reach 84 this afternoon, currently 67 degrees. Overnight, a clear sky, a low of 58, and tomorrow Thursday, maybe some morning clouds, but then sunny again by afternoon with a high of 82. Over the past year, Seattle has added nearly 2,000 new apartments, yet rents are still going up. What's that all about? We'll try to find out in 10 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. 13 million American kids will be bullied this year, and 3 million will stay home from school because of it. Used to be summer vacation was a reprieve for kids who were bullied on the school playground, but now teasing has gone online. How serious an issue is bullying? Katie Sewell spoke with Rosetta Lee. She's a sixth grade science teacher and national anti-bullying educator. Katie asked Lee, what types of bullying are common these days?
The bullying that kids are experiencing these days have to do with their gender as well as what their identity sets are. So girls and boys experience bullying differently because of gender bias, what society expects boys and girls to be. So girls are expected to be nice and kind and friends with everyone, and there's so much focus on their looks, they experience bullying around things like not being pretty enough or not being popular enough. And the tools of bullying, because they're so not allowed to express direct aggression, it shows up in things like rumor spreading or not pretending that somebody's not there or things like that. For boys, because of the focus on their physical strength and power, they experience bullying on more physical and direct terms, like threatening, name-calling, pushing around, those kind of things. So it depends on you know, whether you're a boy or a girl, that the form of bullying changes.
And is there a difference between girls and boys and how they internalize the bullying that they're subjected to?
Sure. I think you will find that in the research, what shows up is that girls who persistently get bullied turn in on themselves, turn the violence in on themselves. So they do things like engage in eating disorders or cutting themselves, and they sort of turn into fantasize in a sort of damsel in distress kind of way. Whereas boys, they resort to a fantasy world where they become the lone wolf, and they engage in things like extreme sports where hurting themselves is more externalized.
So it almost sounds like the way that the girls internalize it is potentially more damaging.
Certainly harder to see. Because the bullying is so relational and indirect, adults have a hard time realizing what kind of impact that it's having. But thankfully, brain science is really getting farther ahead, where functional magnetic resonance imaging or brain scans while the brain is in action is showing the physical pain and psychological pain registers basically in the same areas and to the same degree. And so we really need to pay attention to the social and relational aggression, because it's impacting girls. When I do workshops among adults, I will ask often, you know, do you remember the specific person or occasion or what they look like who bullied you when you were in middle school or high school? And what's interesting is that for women, they remember to a T who their persecutors were. And clearly that memory has followed them. I've had 80-year-old women just be in tears about the bullying she experienced in junior high. So this is long-term stuff.
What do you think of adults that say, this is kids being kids, this is part of growing up, we all went through this?
There's a little bit of truth in that, but there's also a call for us not to take that complacently. So it's true, cyberbullying has existed for a long time. You know, you're young, you're trying to figure out who you are. A lot of your ego is tied into your group membership. So, of course, there's going to be a lot of volleying. And kids, because they don't have a whole lot of power, will express power in whatever ways they can, which is through, you know, social domination. However, just because it has been the case doesn't mean it has to be the case. Certainly, society has gone through so many positive changes when people realize, you know, this is wrong. You think about racism or sexism. If people kept on saying this is always the way it's been, change just wouldn't have happened. And I hope that we're in that social cusp where adults will say, you know what, just because this happened before doesn't mean it's right. Furthermore, I think how kids experience it these days can be more severe because of the online world. It used to be that you go to school and maybe the bully picked on you, and if you managed to avoid them during the day, then you could come home to a sanctuary. Whereas with the online world, it's it can be a 24/7 where the stuff follows you and is posted online, and you have no recourse. It's not a in the moment kind of thing. It's a perpetual thing.
Are most parents aware if their kid's being bullied?
Sadly, not as much as they would like. Particularly with younger kids, they're still very much connected to the adults in their lives in terms of seeing them as advocates and support systems and things like that. Developmentally speaking, starting about middle school, they want to disconnect from adults, and it's developmentally natural and normal, and they want to feel a sense of independence. And so if they're getting picked on, and they want to disconnect from their parents, and they want to feel like they're their own person in the world, that's like a Bermuda Triangle of not seeking out help, sadly. So a lot of parents think they know what's up in their kids' lives, but sadly it's not as well known. It's typically only when it gets to that breaking point that parents find out, if they find out at all.
Mm-hmm. What should parents be doing to help their kids if they're the victims of this?
Well, I think for all kids, we need to teach them about the difference between conflict and bullying. I think because of the heightened awareness of bullying, we're starting to call all kid conflict bullying, which I think is dangerous because it's not true. And kids need to experience conflict and try to deal with it on their own. And so for me, it's teaching them about how to have social, healthy interaction skills, particularly through through conflict, and then teach them about the difference between regular old conflict and bullying, which is in bullying, there's a power differential. There's somebody who's bigger or stronger or somebody who's more popular or who has more influence. There's an intent to harm. When you say to somebody, hey, you know, when you do that, it really hurts my feelings and I would appreciate it if you'd stop, and they keep on doing it, there is an intent to harm there. And that it's repeated and sustained. If we can teach kids about the difference, then we can help them identify when bullying is happening. And again, teaching them in conflict, yes, you do go back into the fray, and these are some of the tools that you can use. But in bullying, you deserve better than this. And you shouldn't have to deal with it alone. And I'm here for you. Mm-hmm. So how are those two messages really loud and clear?
I'm speaking with Rosetta Lee, who's a sixth grade science teacher and a national anti-bullying educator. So what about if you're the parent of the bully?
Well, first things first, I think the initial response that parents will often have is, what did I do wrong? Or my kid can't be a bully because I've raised them better than this. I think we need to pay attention to the fact that, again, particularly with teens who are trying to live an independent life, they're in this really tough position in today's world. Again, they're trying to find out who they are and find out a sense of belonging in the world. And they're living in a consumerist world that says you're one of the growing largest consumer bases. And consumerism doesn't work if you're feeling good about yourself. So a lot of advertising and TV programs will basically tell kids you're not good enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not popular enough, and unless you have these things, you're somehow lacking. And so kids are going to respond in some ways. And so for me, if you're a parent of a bully, I think it's important to pay attention to what the impact that they're having on their kids, on other kids have been. And again, not blame them because they're sort of reacting out of a situation that has been boiling outside of parent control often, and say, what are you feeling badly about that you feel the need to do this, and how can I help you find your sense of self and self-confidence that you don't feel the need to resort to these behaviors?
And do you think that would work if you have a teenager that's sort of shoving you away or not wanting to listen to that kind of advice at this point?
Here's my take, is that teenagers, I forget who the author said this, which author said this, but they said teenagers never seem to be listening, but they never fail to imitate you. And so it may not be that your words or that long lecture that you give has any impact, but your daily actions and living out your values will. And so for me, it's not have a 200-minute conversation about bullying and then leave it at that. It's about have 200 one-minute conversations while you're driving them somewhere or watching TV together. Little ways to remind them, you are better than this, and I believe in you, and there is a bigger and greater world that you want to be a healthy part of.
What if you're an adult and you're carrying with you the bullying you experienced as a child? Do you have any advice for adults that are still reflecting on that moment in time?
Sure. Again, how do we look back on that moment and say we deserve better than this? And how do we reflect on that moment and say the person who was persecuting me, as much as we want to vilify them, I constantly remind myself, nobody gets up in the morning feeling really great. I love, you know, my life. School's going great. My parents love me and everything's just perfect. I'm going to go pick on somebody. Ultimately, having some generosity toward the person who was enacting those things, really thinking about it wasn't me. It was about that person. And finally, thinking about the fact that a lot of our teenage experiences really hardwire our brains. And so really thinking about how do I continue to stay silent when something bad is happening to me? How do I advocate for myself and do so in a healthy way? Because ultimately, we rewire those channels by acting, not by thinking about it.
That's national anti-bullying educator Rosetta Lee. She spoke with KOW's Katie Sewell. This is Weekday. From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Almost 2,000 new apartments have been added to the Seattle market since the start of 2013, but the increase in apartments hasn't stopped rents from going up. The average monthly rent in King County is about $1,200. That's over the past year, rents have gone up more than 5.8%. What is driving these skyrocketing rental prices, and what do rising rents say about the economic health of the city of Seattle? Glenn Crellin joins us now. He's Associate Director for Research at the University of Washington's Ronstadt Center for Real Estate Studies. Thanks for coming into the station today.
I'm pleased to be here.
I thought that increased supply meant that, and in this case of apartments, would mean that rents would go down because there's more out there. But that's not what's happened.
Well, it's not what's happened for a couple of reasons. Number one, the newly constructed units are going to be coming onto the market at a much higher rent because they were more expensive to build. And secondly, despite the fact that these new units are coming onto the market, the vacancy rate is continuing to decline. And as a result, you've got more demand than you've got supply, even with the new product. And that means the rents are increasing.
The latest figures that I saw showed that vacancy rate was below 5% in the Seattle area. Is that correct?
No, it's actually below 5% throughout the state of Washington in almost every community you look at. And 5% is generally viewed by the development community as that break point, that when it's below 5, they're willing to invest in new product. And when it's above 5, then you're not going to see much in the way of rent increases.
Is this vacancy rent rate something that's been steady, or are we seeing even a decline in vacancies?
We're seeing a decline in vacancies right now. One has to remember that as these new units come on the market, they're not going to be included in the vacancy rate statistics immediately. That is, that the researchers want to make sure that they have had an opportunity to achieve stabilized occupancy. Indirectly, however, they are included in the statistics because as tenants move from established units into the new units, those properties that are included in the surveys theoretically would be seeing increasing vacancies, and they're just not.
Do you have a sense of the percentage of rental housing versus owned housing in Seattle?
I don't have those statistics on my fingertips. Certainly, the city of Seattle has a lower homeownership rate than the remainder of the state of Washington. But that is typical of major urban areas all over the country. Vacancy rates or ownership rates have declined a bit through the recession, but we're now seeing a lot of people moving back to homeownership in the last 9 to 12 months.
We're talking with Glenn Crellin, who is Associate Director for Research at the University of Washington's Ronstadt Center for Real Estate Studies. You mentioned that these 2,000 new units are mostly higher
higher rent. They'll fetch a higher price on the market. Does that mean that developers are not investing in more moderate housing units?
It really doesn't. Although many of the units are in higher rent neighborhoods, they're being built to standards that certainly would allow them to convert them to condos down the road if that is deemed appropriate. But the construction costs themselves, whether it's the cost of the land or the labor or the materials, simply makes it very, very difficult unless you have subsidies to build for a significantly more modest rental rate, unless you are in a place where the land costs are much lower.
You mentioned condos. I know that right before the recession hit big time in Seattle, a lot of the condo developments, because that was what was being built here, were being converted to apartments.
And exactly.
Do they flip back to condos at some point? Is there a magic key where that changes?
I'm sort of expecting that will happen at some point, particularly for some of the buildings that were originally intended to be condos. But I haven't heard of that conversion underway yet.
What neighborhoods have been most affected by these rising rents?
Unfortunately, the statistics doesn't give us anything specifically on South Lake Union itself.
Mm.
But in terms of the established neighborhoods, we're seeing rapidly rising rents in Ballard, on First Hill, Queen Anne. I mean, it's the normal suspects.
So does that tell you something specific about the type of people who are renting versus the type of people who might be able to buy a home in Seattle?
Well, I think we've got a rental pool that is right now being dominated by young professionals. Look at all the jobs that have been added by Amazon. A lot of those new employees are looking to be very close to work, and that's going to be some of these very same neighborhoods.
So a lot of that, you said they're not breaking out South Lake Union specifically now, but a lot of the development and a lot of the multifamily kinds of units are being built close to that neighborhood, right?
Exactly.
And I'm assuming that they're anticipating that people who might get jobs in either the biotech industry or at Amazon, those major employers who are down there want to live near where they're working.
Exactly. And what we're seeing is that those statistics one of the markets, the Lower Queen Anne market, becomes almost adjacent to South Lake Union, very convenient to those offices. And that's one of the places where we're seeing big rent jumps and also a large amount of construction.
I can't remember exactly when this was. It was probably right around 2008, 2009, when the recession hit as well, that there was this mantra that not only could you not get a home loan because the banks had tightened up, but that it was better to rent than to buy. Is that still the case?
It certainly depends on the individual situation. Rents have been increasing enough during the period of time while the home values were stagnant or declining that the equation really had moved more in terms of favoring home buyers, particularly with the extraordinarily low mortgage rates that are, even though they've increased a bit in the last few weeks, are still an absolute bargain.
How does Seattle compare to Bellevue, Everett, and Tacoma when it comes to the rental market?
Very comparable. I mentioned the rent increases that we're seeing in various Seattle submarkets, but I was looking at data from Dupre plus Scott on those particular statistics, material that had come out by Apartment Insights Washington had indicated that the Bellevue markets, particularly the downtown Bellevue markets, were seeing similar sorts of very rapid rent increases.
Are we seeing in these new 2,000 units or whatever else might come on the market, bigger apartments, for example, apartments meant for families as opposed to single hipster adults?
Exactly the opposite.
We're not seeing family.
No, indeed.
Oh.
We lived at the top of Queen Anne in a rental project when we first moved to Seattle. And that developer has put in two additional projects since we moved in, much larger than the building that we were residing in. And neither of those buildings has anything larger than a one-bedroom and den unit.
I'm assuming that these employers in South Lake Union, if that's what's driving the increase in prices, that these employers might be hiring people that have kids. I mean, they're not just hiring single people out of college. So will employer demand have to drive the type of apartment development that builders look to?
One would presume so. I mean, obviously, the commute is something that the employees, regardless of whether they are the just out of college students or those with families, are looking at as a real negative. And as a result, they're looking at close-in neighborhoods, whether it's to own or to rent, and whether it's in an apartment or a rental house.
So say you are one of those employees looking to live close-in. Is there even a house or a condo that you could find on the market right now to buy if you can't find an apartment to rent?
The inventory available for sale in all price points and in all neighborhoods, while it is improving modestly, is still very, very limited. We usually look at wanting somewhere between a 5 and 7 month supply of homes on the market in order to have good choices. And right now, throughout the King County area, we're looking at about a 2.5 month supply.
And is that just because people are reluctant to put their homes on the market?
Well, it's a combination of a much more active market than we'd seen for the last 5 years, plus lenders that had taken back properties through foreclosure have been very slow in terms of putting those homes back on the market, plus the owners that are underwater or think they may be underwater have been reluctant to list until the price has recovered. And I think the fact that the prices are recovering are beginning to bring some of those properties to market.
So we've got not a lot of product to buy, available to buy. We don't have a lot of product available to rent. That's driving up rents, driving up housing costs. This is what you guys term a hot real estate market. That's a good thing, or is this a bad thing?
Depends on which side of the street you're on.
I guess so.
It's certainly an improving situation for the current owners that are looking to move to something different. And it's a challenging market, whether you're looking to rent or looking to buy an affordable unit in the very near future.
Glenn, are you guys, I mean, you're looking at statistics, you're not crystal ball gazers, but if somebody were looking, I'm coming to Seattle, I need to rent a place, do I want to jump out ahead and come 3 months early, or are things going to loosen up in 6 months? What do you forecast?
You know, I don't have my finger on the pulse of the delivery schedules for apartments. There's certainly plenty more apartment units in the construction pipeline. There are two very large buildings in Ballard, very near where we bought our condo earlier this year, one of which is in the early stages of rent up. The other one won't even be available for rentals until the end of the year. So there's a lot of new product coming online.
I see a lot of cranes out there building something. I'm not quite sure if they're building apartments or are people building condos now? Are those available for purchase?
To the best of my knowledge, there's only one significant condo development under construction right now.
Wow. So what?
And it's at the very high end in downtown.
Okay.
Very expensive units.
So it's not somebody who's just starting out on a career necessarily could buy. Are there any neighborhoods that are insulated from all this kind of skyrocketing price?
Well, there are some neighborhoods, particularly in the southern part of King County, that haven't seen rents rising or home prices rising as rapidly as other neighborhoods. But they're probably poised to begin some gentrification and coming back into the market as well.
So, in a sense, does the activity in the center city push the prices further out, like in concentric rings of circles?
Exactly. It radiates outward, and the center, the most convenient locations are where the market is hottest right now.
So just to circle back to something that I think I heard you say at the beginning of our conversation about more modest rental prices, unless there's some kind of subsidy or program, we're not going to see much construction on the low rent end of the market.
It's very, very difficult without the subsidies, whether it's the low-income housing tax credits or some of the other programs that are out there.
So really what it sounds like at this point is that Seattle will continue to be a city mostly of childless people who are fairly well employed if they want to own or rent in the city itself.
Well, one wonders whether the childless part is really there. Otherwise, you wouldn't have the city talking about a school in downtown Seattle for the first time in decades. So there are children that are coming back into some of these projects.
I'm assuming then if we build a school in South Lake Union for the children of the workers who are living in South Lake Union, maybe we're going to see some housing for those children to live in.
Yeah, there will be some that will be larger units.
Hmm. Well, thank you. It's fascinating. I suppose economically this is all good news. We're not seeing prices drop, so that must say something about the economy.
Yeah, well, we've got enough jobs coming in, and population of the Seattle metropolitan area is growing. We're certainly one of the brighter spots in the national economic scene.
Glenn Crellin is Associate Director for Research at the University of Washington's Rundstad Center for Real Estate Studies. Thanks for coming in today.
I really enjoyed it, Marcy.
This is Weekday. And now, the sound of the day. Sounds like outer space, Bernard, doesn't it?
I don't know what to make of it.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. Our listener Paul sent us this sound. He recorded it over the weekend while at the Daybreak Star Seafair powwow. Paul was taking a walk through the woods and he came upon a statalou, I think that's how you say it, a little stream that was babbling away. And what you hear in the distance is the powwow drum song. Now we'll listen a little. So now you can hear it, right?
Yes, I can. Now that you've described what it is, I understand what's happening.
Exactly. And the word statalou is a Saanich tribal word from southern Vancouver Island. So there, now you know what that little stream is called. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Record 30 seconds of that sound and send it to us along with the story behind the sound. Email that audio file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure you include sound of the day in the subject line. I like that. It's kind of cool. Coming up in the next hour, Vaughn Palmer, Robert Horton, and Todd Bishop will be in to talk about Microsoft's woes. So stay with us for that.
It's a minute before 10 o'clock. Yesterday on KUOW, we spent some time contemplating a variety of answers to the question, what does it mean to be a woman? Today we ask, what does it mean to be a man? How have perceptions of masculinity changed? And how do they continue to change? We'll take that up today during the noon hour, and we'd love to include your comments. Give us a call right now with your thoughts. 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. What does it mean to be a man? That's today during the noon hour. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Eden Saw Woods of Port Townsend, now offering walk green hardwood decking. Hardwoods from producers committed to practicing responsible forestry and following forest stewardship.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.